Welcome to episode 11 of All of Your Business. These are the vulnerable, authentic, and unfiltered stories of business owners whose currents raise tides that lift all of our businesses, communities, and dreams. Before we get started, we are proud to announce that All of Your Business podcast has received a 2020 X-Ray Podcast Award presented by X-Ray FM. X-Ray FM, purpose-driven media at 91.1 FM and 107.1 FM, and find them online at xray.fm. Today's episode is brought to you by Iron Tap Station. 33 taps, nothing but craft. You're about to hear our conversation with the founder of Green Drop Garage, Farhad Ghafrizadeh. Green Drop Garage is a full-service auto shop on a mission to deliver stress-free car care while leading the way for eco-conscious business. And now your host, Michael Jonas.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
I actually brought my car into your Selma location, the one by the 7-Eleven, the other day, and I was really impressed by how organized they were, how everything was sanitized. You know, it was a pretty good process, so.
It was good. Good to hear.
Yeah, I'm sure people appreciate that. I appreciate you chatting with me. So kind of just wanted to talk about first, take it back to your childhood and upbringing. Can you kind of tell me, you know, how you got to Portland? I know that could take hours, but in a nutshell.
How I got to Portland, how I moved to Portland?
Yeah, like where you're from and how you ended up in Portland.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So I grew up in Beaverton, just a suburb of Portland. Long story short, I went to college in Santa Cruz in California and never thought I'd come back to Portland. I think a lot of people of my generation, we all grew up wanting to leave Portland, and then we realized how great Portland is after college and we moved back. So I'm a Portland, or I'm a Beavertonian, but I like to claim Portland. I'm kind of from around here.
Yeah, and it sounds like it's changed a lot, you know, in the past 5 or 10 years. So what's your thought on that, like this, how the city is changing?
Yeah, the city's changed a lot, but I think growth is good. There's a lot of good. I mean, there's some things that of course need to be better or more thoughtful, but overall I think Portland net, of course there's problems with growth, like I said, with gentrification and some other problems, but overall it's really been fun watching the city grow and become a little bit bigger of a player in the scene of small business, arts, food, all that stuff. So it's kind of fun to watch it grow.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I agree with that too. And I like how you brought up the gentrification issue of course, we want that to be done responsibly and for people to be at the table who maybe are displaced or should have opportunities to be part of that gentrification process.
Yeah.
So how did you, you know, come to opening a garage? You know, is it something that you thought of for a while? Is it something that you sort of had this quick thought and then thought, you know, that's a perfect idea? Like, how did you come about that business concept?
Well, out of college, I was actually pre-med. I was going to go to dental school or med school. So I just came back to Portland and I didn't have an idea to start a car repair shop. I was converting cars to run on vegetable oil just to make some spending money to pay off my student loans and to live. But long story short, I was posting on Craigslist about my services. I could convert a car to vegetable oil and people would call me. And that morphed into a more full-time kind of, I got a shop that I would work out of during the day. And then I would work in the evenings as a bartender at a brew pub nearby. So again, I was still doing the conversions on the side to pay down student debt. I never thought it was going to be a career. And the big break came when Portland Monthly did a story on me in 2008. And then, you know, a true mechanic found me and wanted to work with me and learn about vegetable oil conversions, where you convert your diesel to run on vegetable oil. And that was the split where I started running a business where he would convert cars to vegetable oil. And because he was an actual mechanic, we could do everything else like brakes and oil changes and things like that. So it was kind of a natural progression from me just doing the work that I knew, like converting a car to vegetable oil, and I was still kind of hacking it. I was never a classically trained mechanic, to working with a mechanic that believed in what we were doing. And that's what kind of spurred the creation of Green Drop Garage, like a full service car repair shop that also converts cars to run on vegetable oil.
Yeah, I like what you said about how you had to work at a bar or brew pub at night. Just the concept of, you know, doing whatever it takes to both survive and then to work on the thing that you want to do. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Like how you went from either having multiple jobs or building a business until the point of being able to actually live and profit off of that business?
So you want me to talk about the process, like the
About how usually in life, a lot of times people can't just open a business and then make enough money to survive on that. There may be a need to have a part-time job or a couple part-time jobs. What was it like for you, like that transition?
Well, so that it was a for me, I was lucky. I was young enough with few enough demands on my time and resources that I could really just put all my energy into opening it up. So I, was working as a bartender at a brew pub. And when I started Green Drop Garage, I actually moved into the office of the shop for the first year and a half because I couldn't afford rent. So I would work all day in the shop and still work nights and weekends as a bartender. In my startup capital, because the banks weren't lending to anyone really. This was 2009. It was the credit crunch time. The other is that I was 26 with student debt, no assets, no nothing. So the banks kind of laughed at me. And so I maxed out my credit card. And that's how I bought my first bit of equipment, a lift. And everything else was just hacking it, making sure that there was enough money in the account to pay the paycheck and minimizing my own costs. It was a tough go the first couple of years financially. So I made no money, and that's okay. It's an investment. And I was working about 100 hours a week. So I really did have the passion for the process. Like I enjoyed every way. Because when I was living in a shop, that was fun, and I knew it wouldn't last forever.
Yeah.
But you know, when you don't have money, you find other ways of making it work. It's fun. Ironically, looking back, if someone had funded me the money that I was asking for, I probably wouldn't have been successful in getting it to the stage it's at now. Because with the scarcity of money, it's kind of like a haiku. When you have scarcity of space or resources are just constraints, you become creative with the space you do have. So I got a lot more creative with Green Drop Garage, and that spurred out a lot of cool little mini innovations.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you saying that, that, you know, you have to use what you have and be creative. It sounds like you put, you know, not just the skills into this, but your love of community. And the environment, of course, with being a green garage. Can you talk a little bit about that? Like what being a green business means to you? You are a certified B Corp. And then also a little bit more about the community involvement that you do as well.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I enjoy engaging people. Like I like people. So when I started Green Drop Garage, I wanted to make sure that it was a, we fix cars, we're a repair shop. But what I'm really here for is to like connect with people. So from the beginning, what we did was it was repair and vegetable oil conversions. And we also had car care classes in the evening because I really enjoyed teaching. So from the beginning, we had that mindset of connecting with people. So it's really just finding those ways to connect with the community. So early on, we did a lot of benefit concerts for local nonprofits that we believed in. So we didn't have any money, but we had our space because we paid the lease 24 hours a day, but we'd only work maybe about 8 hours a day. So in the evenings, we could have a concert that would raise money for some local some local organization. So we found creative ways to help where we could. And that was really fun. And of course, we wanted to be as eco-friendly as possible while still having a good quality product out. The way I see eco-friendly isn't, maybe it's not, the view isn't shared by all. I don't see eco-friendly as a purpose. I actually see it as more like table stakes. Like you're supposed to do it. Like if you're doing it, you just shouldn't be in business. It's kind of like, you know, if someone says I'm in business and I'm a super honest and trustworthy person in business, and then I'm thinking like, yeah, of course. Like if you're not, you shouldn't be in business. So it's hard. I mean, though we tout ourselves as eco-friendly, as time goes on, I've de-emphasized talking about it, not because we're not, we're actually more, every quarter we get more eco-friendly and find ways to reduce our carbon footprint and to have less waste and all that. But I just see it as like a necessary component of being in business. So yeah, that's why it's kind of like, I want to promote it, but at the same time, it's like, I almost want to be known more for the quality work that we do and the community engagement that we have, because eco-friendly is almost just an expectation out of what we do.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. And it's something that everybody should do in the best way possible. The other thing that I've noticed a lot about your business is, it's very good communication, very strong process oriented. You know, even if you go to your website, you see it says that there's no hidden fees, there's no upselling. Usually when you take your car to a place, or as I even remember as a child, my dad would take the car to a place and we would think it was one thing and we would come back with six recommendations, or not really understand the costs. We didn't know what the parts were build at or the labor, or kind of understand anything that was going on. And of course you want your car fixed because you want to be safe. So you probably just do that, or you find a way to pay the person who knows about fixing it. So can you kind of talk about that? Like, how do you make sure that people know you, trust you, communicate well with you? Because I think that's a really important part of your business and why people come back to you, is that communication and that process.
Yeah, so I remember in college, my cousin, she gave me a gift, a book, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. So are you familiar with that book?
I am. I've read it many years ago. So.
Yeah, this is a while ago. I mean, it's one of those books that was written like in the 70s, but it's timeless. So there's one principle, and I don't remember the exact wording of it, but it's basically like, if you want to be recognized as something, like be that thing, be who you want to be recognized as. Like, there's no faking it. So fundamentally, if we want to be known as an honest shop, which I think is again table stakes, it's unfortunate it's not in car repair. Then we actually have to be honest. So fundamentally, it's the culture where we don't incentivize that level of upselling and overselling based on finance. But going from there, you know, everything is like, we invested in things that make it more clear. So from the point of sale system, where we use pictures and videos to show you what's actually going on with the vehicle, to the process of communication that we've laid out, because I actually want to be honest, and there's enough good, honest work to do on cars that we don't have to sacrifice any integrity to do so. It's just really about actually being clear. And the other thing that I really didn't like about car repair shops is that a lot of mechanics rely on that black box mentality, where the car is the black box, they're the oracle or whatever, they're the ones that can peer into it, and you have to pay them to unlock little bits of information. And I don't think the world works that way anymore. Now it's supposed to be the abundance mentality, where the client has all the information, and so long as you are a honest, good, true person that brings that information, then it's only natural that they trust you to solve the problem that you found. And that's the new way of doing it. It's actually in a lot of industries, like, you know, even selling cars. The old model is that used car salesman, right? Like they oversell you, you don't know what you're buying, and they sell you a lemon of a car. Sure. Like Matilda's dad in that book. And now you go to like CarMax, it's the opposite. There's one price, no haggle, much more clear and easy transaction. And it's happening in all industries. Car repair is just lagging in building that trust with the client.
So for you, you think it's necessary for the times, but it also sounds like you do that process because it speaks to your morals.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, there's a million ways, there's a million jobs I could have. I don't need car repair. I want to be here. So if I need it to make a buck, I am in the wrong industry. There's a lot of easier ways to make a buck. So if I'm here because I want to be here, I want to make sure I can sleep at night and make sure I can, you know, I'm doing the right thing. I don't need to lie, cheat, or steal, or manipulate any situation to make a buck.
Yeah, and one of the things I've noticed about you, you know, is that you really do care about your employees and you hire intentionally. And I think that that's really important to this. Because you not only have that horizontal communication where you know that, you know, you need them just like they need you, but you're not sort of sitting on your ivory tower, like barking commands. Everything is a conversation. You're making sure that everyone wants to be there and believes in the company and what you're doing. Can you just kind of talk a little bit about hiring, like when you're hiring someone, what that looks like? It's probably different than other auto shops in that hiring process to make sure the team is right.
Yeah. You know, lately especially, we've been attracting a certain breed of employee, from technician to service advisor and manager. Because we've become a little bit more established in who we are, we're seeing that our values and our stature in the community has attracted a different breed. So we get actually a higher level applying to work with us. So we look for, number one is values. Do they align with our values? So we have three values: do the right thing, solve problems, get it done. And that's it. That's the order of importance. So do the right thing is the moral part, where you are true with your word. You're honest. Solving problems is also really important to me, where in our engagements with customers and each other, every day we're given a problem to solve. So we're given a car by a customer to solve to the service advisor. The service advisor turns around and gives a diagnostic to produce to the technician. Now that technician needs to produce a solution back up to the service advisor so the service advisor can produce that solution to the customer. It's amazing how many people we found that answer a problem with a problem.
Yeah. Right?
And we look for people who answer a problem with a solution. They might acknowledge the problem, but then say, here's the solution for that. For example, let's say an employee needs to take tomorrow off. Okay. There are employees that say, I need to take tomorrow off. It's an emergency. It's a family thing, whatever. And then they're off. And then they leave the manager or someone else to solve their problem. an example of a solution provider is, hey, I need to take tomorrow off. I have called this other person who can cover my shift for me. So then they present that solution to the manager. Way different mentality than the first one. And that goes through with cars. I mean, there's plenty of mechanics that you come in with a car problem and then they hit the customer with another problem without a solution in mind. So we, you know, we're very solutions oriented. And then get it done. We'd still like people who are producers, competitive and producers. So the more you produce, the more you should get paid. Not that money is everything, but it's something. So we want to make sure that they're rewarded for their hard work. So a mechanic who's very efficient gets paid more than the mechanic who's inefficient. So that's the lens that we look at. That's the first thing that we look at with people is values. And we test them, we ask them questions that pertain to those. So that's how we get them in. And of course, when they come in, GreenDrop isn't a easy place to work. It's actually quite difficult. There's a lot of work. We are a very fast changing company for the automotive industry. So it's not an easy place to work. It's a rewarding place to work. And we regularly are reminded of that with so many changes that come about. Like we actually just opened up our fifth location yesterday.
Wow, congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a tire. It's actually next to our central location, the first location, but we took over the building next door. So it's a full tire and alignment shop. So with that, we have to update our processes and add more staff and all of that. So there's just a lot of changes about with GreenDrop. So it's not, you got to be on your toes and you got to really be kind of on your game to keep up with everything that's going on at GreenDrop.
Yeah, and how has the pandemic affected you? You know, I think you had mentioned that your wife had COVID at one point, and you are kind of making sure not only for your family, but for your staff that they're all safe and healthy. But how does that affect your business, for example, and what clients may or may not want? So what are some of the changes or the things that you had to implement for health and safety?
So for health and safety, my wife had all the symptoms. So we were just kind of quarantined for the better part of a month. So I worked remotely, working with my staff. But she's all better now. Thank you. With COVID, I mean, operationally, March and April were a little scary, just like everyone else in business. But it came roaring back. I think people see their cars as a sanctuary right now. So we're actually seeing higher demand than normal because, if people were planning on taking flying somewhere, they're now driving. So we're seeing more demand now. We've actually hired a few people to keep up with that demand. So that's just been interesting to see. You know, car repair right now is a little bit more of an essential needed service. So for us, it's been okay. What we do internally, we take COVID very seriously. So have you been to a New Seasons lately?
I have, yeah.
So New Seasons out of the grocery store seems to take it the most seriously. And so for car repair, we're approaching that level, mask-wise, sanitation-wise, and all of that. Now, we have technicians working in a big workshop, so everyone's, usually spaced over 10 feet apart, and it kind of feels like an outdoor space sometimes with all the garage doors open. But we're taking all the precautions, so, masking and sanitizing, and, I think you've probably seen it, we will sanitize going into a car and sanitize coming out of a car. So the door handle, the wheel, the air, we wipe down everything. On top of that, we have like a little special where we can do a deep sanitize, for a fee for customers. But the few things that we've done that have really been successful during COVID is we offer a pickup and drop off service for people who don't want to leave the house. So that's been really popular. And the other has been texting us. So even email and calling is sometimes too tedious or too much for someone who's really busy. So we have a text line where you can just text us your questions about the car or scheduling or whatever else, and we respond. And that's been super popular with our customers, and it gets them in easier and quicker. So it's actually helped business quite a bit by providing that service. So COVID's changed things. And honestly, I think it's a good thing that it's changed things. I don't like being in this space where it's the COVID economy and the uncertainty. But the good that will come out of it is these small little innovations that companies come up with to cope with it. I think the ones that survive are going to be set up really well for success once COVID's over. I think this is a good economic test for a lot of companies.
Yeah, well, it sounds like you have, developed all these processes and the whole team has talked about them and how best to implement them. Is there anybody that, maybe an employee said, I don't want to do this, or they're not taking it seriously? And if so, what sort of process has to happen there?
So we have employees who are uncomfortable, especially in the beginning. And we don't make anyone do anything they don't want to do. So the ones who are uncomfortable performing a job, we allow them to not perform the job, but they, then we have to find someone who can. So we had, especially during the March time, we had employees volunteer to be temporarily laid off. So that's number one. No one's forced to do anything. It is no matter what, it's a risk to work right now because it ups the exposure risk. But, unfortunately, we're not like other more civilized countries where we can have our government take care of us a little bit better. We still have to work to survive. So, and we also have customers who need our services. So, so the first part you were saying, if someone's uncomfortable, we allow them to refuse to do work, anything that's, if they perceive that it's a risk to their health and well-being during COVID, they're allowed. And what was your second question off of that?
Just if someone had given pushback, how you would deal with that. It sounds like maybe you would have a conversation with them to see what they were concerned about.
Yeah. So, if they give push, if a customer, or I'm sorry, an employee gives pushback, we let them know what we've done, and we're complying with all state mandates and everything like that. But if they're still uncomfortable, they are welcome to not, without penalty, they just can't work, but they're not penalized, at least, until they're ready to come back to work. We also, if anyone has any symptoms, they go get tested, and then they have to, they have to isolate for 2 weeks. So we have all those policies in place. And hopefully, we don't have to use some of those more we don't have to go through any of those COVID scares, but if anyone tests positive, we have to shut down that location, that shop, for 2 days while everyone gets tested, and then open back up. So we've also limited exposure between shops. So we used to have team meetings between shops. Now everything is virtual. So that even if someone at one shop has an infection, they don't spread it to the other shops. Only one location has to close down, not the whole company.
That's smart.
So it's kind of like, yeah, and we're not only just looking out for the economic viability of the company, but also jobs. If the shop has to close down, we can't afford to keep paying people. We got to produce to pay. So it's, we're defending people's paychecks more than anything.
Yeah, and I also noticed online that you had some sort of program for essential workers that maybe need help with car care. Can you talk a little bit about that program?
Yeah, so we got it's like most companies during this time, we got the Paycheck Protection Program assistance from the SBA. So we hired everyone back off of their temporary layoffs, and we had some extra bandwidth, meaning demand wasn't all the way up yet. So I said, all right, we have extra bandwidth. We're going to pay people to be here. No one wants to just stand around. I don't want them to stand around, and the employee themselves, they'd rather work than just stand around. So I said, well, we can donate some of our services. Who should we donate it to? And because we already have the membership platform, it was really easy to just say, all right, essential workers right now, frontline essential workers, could use a little help. Because they're working, keeping us safe or keeping us supplied with groceries or rides or healthcare. So because we had that extra bandwidth due to PPP, I thought we could just put it to better use than just having people stand around. So we got to donate some of our time and energy to these people. So we gave them 6 months just free membership, no strings attached. We just covered the 6 months of it. Whether they're a current member or they were new, all they had to do was apply and prove that they were frontline. So it was like a pay stub or something like that. And it was pretty successful. We've had, I think, hundreds of people have used the program or on it now. And it's a win-win. Like, they get service, which is great. We're still financially being responsible. We're not just giving away our services. It can be considered marketing because, let's say, a percentage of those people, if they like what they see, will convert to regular customers after 6 months.
Sure.
So it's a win-win. It's good PR. But fundamentally, it's the help. So if we can help, everything else is just icing on the cake.
Well, and then also, it speaks to your love of community and the fact that there's a social enterprise model here of, you have a company that makes money, you're hiring people, you're helping essential workers, and then the essential workers are essentially helped and then have a car so that they can get to where they need to go. I think all around that's a really good idea that helps a variety of people. You mentioned that they would be a member of that membership program, and I know that's something you do for anybody who's interested. Can you talk a little bit about how the membership program works and maybe why you developed that program?
Yeah, so for our shop, we do oil changes all the way through to tires and engine work. But people come in all day, every day for oil changes that we schedule them, and they used to be $40. And then if you need that air filter, you need the wipers, you need the small stuff, the things that cost $30 or less per item. We'd spend our time educating you on why you need it and then sell it if you needed it. But the problem is, I think Jiffy Lube and Oil Can Henry's especially have really kind of eroded the trust of people. So here we are trying to fight against that stereotype. Like, no, you actually do need an air filter this time. They may have lied to you before, but we're not. Mm-hmm. So that got me thinking, like, we shouldn't even be selling this. We should just be including it in the service. But raising our prices to include everything as a full meal deal seemed less palatable because people were conditioned to that $20 to $40 price point for oil changes. Fun fact, a $40 oil change is a break even for a lube shop, an oil change shop, meaning it's a loss leader. If you go in for a $40 oil change and leave without buying anything more, they have made zero. They've actually lost money on you due to the space you took up at their shop for half an hour. It's only there to bring you in to sell you other stuff. Now, it's hard to compete against that perception. It's hard to just say, oh, it's the $100 oil change. So what we did instead, I go, okay, I want to provide the full service, and I can't get myself to go too high in a price point without giving a way to spread it out over time. So I figured, I said, I was on a plane, I think, and I was talking to someone about memberships, about like how Netflix does it and how Amazon Prime has the membership and how it's so easy and all that. Well, that'd be awesome for the basic level services that we do. If we price it at, and I didn't know what the price would be at the time, but I said, if we make it easy enough, instead of like bringing customers in on a loss leader and then selling them the stuff they we believe they need, but and you know, we still have to make a dollar. But instead of doing that, like, why don't I just give them everything and only focus on consulting on things that are important, or not important, but like bigger things like brakes or engine maintenance or things like that. So that's how it came about. I mean, just from recoiling from having to, from the experience of selling the small stuff. We didn't want to sell small stuff anymore. We wanted to be more full service. So that membership, it started off, and when I started it, I had basically all my executive staff hated the idea. And I, so much, they told me it's running me out of business. And I knew I had to get to thousands of members for it to really pencil out. So that instead of looking at it as each customer as a profit center, I looked at it as a portfolio that of customers that were productive. So no one customer makes us money on this model. The collective is a financially viable operation, but then it allows us to just employ a technician like a salaried level. Like, you're not worrying about the unit margin on customers. You're just worried about the monthly income from the membership to offset the cost of that technician. So it's just a different model. That was spurned by how I hated selling the small stuff and fighting against the mistrust that has been built in by decades of quick lube lies.
Yeah, and what's included in that membership? I mean,
oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, on the membership, we include the oil change, the air filter, the wipers, bulbs, tires rotated, and a safety inspection, unlimited for $15 a month. So you just got to schedule online,
which is a really good deal. So what if, like, someone came up to you and said, whether it's your executive team or someone in the community, they said, you know, giving away these things or doing things at a discount, they're great, but they're going to cut into your bottom line and you may have profit issues. Like, what would you say back to that person? I mean, how do you respond to something like that?
Well, I looked at the Amazon Prime model. Okay. And I didn't dive too deep into the finances of Amazon Prime, but you pay $100 a year and they give you free shipping and a bunch of other stuff, movies, music, whatever it is. Whatever they're giving away at $100 a month, the value to the client is more than $100 a month or a year, sorry, more than $100 a year. Like, if you ship more than 10 packages in a year, you're coming out ahead. So Amazon had something on it. So when my managers were telling me I'm losing money, because we would average $60 per oil change before membership. And now if a customer comes in every 3 months, we're averaging $45 per oil change for the same service. And I said, but we're gonna start to see these people come back more frequently. So our cost of marketing went down because our retention went up. So if someone has a membership at $15 a month, if Jiffy Lube came to you and said, hey, here's a coupon for a free oil change, free on the house, you would say, well, I'm already paying $15 a month to Green Drop. I already have my oil change covered. I'm not going anywhere else.
Sure.
So we retain them. So the cost of acquisition for a customer has dropped. And the lifetime value of the customer has increased because the lifetime of the customer is longer. It went from like 2 years to 5 years, average lifetime of a customer. So these are metrics that aren't typically viewed by auto repair shop decision makers. The auto repair shop decision makers, meaning owners and managers, look at average dollar spent per customer. That's the main thing, dollars per customer. And number of customers. So I said, cool, we have a steady flow of customers and let's just keep it to where we don't have to keep acquiring new customers. Let's keep serving our existing customers better. Like, I always hated seeing those coupons, like 20% off your first service. And in the small print, it's like only for first time customers, basically excluding the people that are loyal to you. They don't get the discount, which is counterintuitive. You're not you're not rewarding the people who have stuck with you. You're just trying to get new people. So I didn't want that. I wanted to make sure that if you, like the $15 a month, if you come in twice a year, you're almost at break even. So if you come in three times a year, you're way ahead with everything else that you're getting on it. So we built it in to reward someone who sticks with us, just like Amazon Prime. You pay $100 a year, but you're rewarded by shopping with Amazon, whether you like or hate Amazon, that's their model, where you get, you perceive that value of free shipping that the Amazon Prime gives you. So you can get hundreds of dollars of value out of your Prime membership every year. So same with the Green Drop membership. We want to reward people for coming back.
Yeah, I think that's great. And, you know, instead of just looking at cost or ROI, like some people do, I mean, you're building relationships that end up being really strong. And so not only do those people stay, but they're going to develop a relationship with your company, and they're going to be likely to tell their friends and tell their family. So you're building, you know, what they call goodwill, and it's priceless. It's invaluable.
Hope you're enjoying our conversation with Farhad, founder of Green Drop Garage, but we'd like to take a moment and thank our sponsors. Iron Tap Station, located in Progress Square in Beaverton. Iron Tap is open and appreciates all of its customers' continued support. Head on in for a drink or a meal. All table service and fills are provided with masks and gloves, and they've expanded their outdoor seating. They've got some exciting weekly specials that include To-Go Tuesdays, which feature a single new local can for $2 a can. They also have a rotating $3 pint special every day of the week, so make sure to check them out. Find out more at irontapstation.com. And now back to more with Farhad and Michael.
So I wanted to ask you, you know, a little bit about where you're at. I mean, I know that you went from having no shop to one shop to now you just told us that you have a fifth one opening. So I wanted to know, you know, if you were to give advice to yourself or what you would have wanted to know back then, what are some of those thoughts? Is there something that you've learned that you can tell maybe one of our listeners if they're going to open a business, which is something that you either learned the hard way or you learned over the course of business over these several years?
Well, a couple of things. One is grit. More than knowledge, strategy, experience, all of that is grit, meaning how do you survive another day, another month, another year, no matter what? Because that's number one. There was plenty of times that I was facing going out of business. I had no money or something bad. Whatever happened, how do you persevere past that? And that's one fundamental trait that needs to be a part of the owner or the leader's mentality to make sure or to ensure the company's viability is grit. But going from there, I think the other things that I've learned along the way is that I, in the beginning especially, I leaned a lot on people who I deemed experts in the field. So I talked to other people who, you know, I'm like, give me some advice. How would you do it? And I would, you know, whether it was for marketing or accounting or whatever else. And I've learned that I know more about myself and my business and how I want to position it in the community than a lot of the experts. Mm. So experts aren't so expert. And I would say the third thing is counter to that. When you're hiring, hire someone who knows more than you. So hire the expert. So it goes both ways. I know more than a lot of experts in how to run my business because they don't know what I know about my own business. A lot of times people give you advice based on how they would do it in their world, but they're not in your world. But in your world, if you're going to hire someone who knows more than you in something. If you're like, when I hired a mechanic who knew way more than I did. I hire a bookkeeper, an office manager. They all can do things that I can't do, but I can relate to all of them in a way that they can't do themselves. So it's a good symbiosis between experts and me.
Well, and I think part of that, you know, necessitates you being self-reflective and, you know, knowing what you know, what you don't know, and admitting when you need to ask someone for either help or their expertise. So I want to ask you our five questions. We ask these questions for every podcast. So the first one is, if you weren't doing this business, what business would you be doing?
I would be running a company that taught people things. So whether it's test prep, I think it would be a school for something outdoors, surfing, hiking, skiing, something like that. But a school that took people outdoors.
Well, that sounds fun. And then if you had a celebrity business partner right now, who would that celebrity business partner be?
I think I gave this to you last time and I forgot who that was, but what comes to mind right now for me would be, I think that I would want to be partners with Shaq.
Oh yeah. And if you could form a squad of people who are dead or alive, who would be in that squad? So people that could kind of lift up your day and help you with advice and things like that.
Dead or alive, how many? I got a few of them.
Maybe a few, yeah.
Okay, so I would say people who would lift me up and give me business advice is what you're saying.
Yeah.
I would think that I do admire Elon Musk a lot, and that would give me, he would definitely be a strong proponent of taking bold steps. So I think he'd be great. Warren Buffett on mitigating risks.
Yeah.
And being financially prudent. And let's round it out with a third one. A third one I think would be, I like Mark Cuban. I like how he talks and how he approaches business.
Yeah, absolutely. When you reach a certain level of success, what is your splurge or your guilty pleasure purchase?
Lately, it's been getting toys for the kids. I get so excited. I got a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old to go and get a comic book for my 3-year-old. He loves superheroes. So it's kind of like that. I'm in the middle of dadhood. So right now, those are my splurges when I have a good day.
Yeah, well, I'd probably travel in non-COVID times.
Yeah, and non-COVID times would be travel. And, you know, I also do enjoy a good remote-controlled something, like an airplane or a helicopter or a drone. So I guess that's another guilty pleasure. I like to play with those little RC toys. So sometimes I would splurge on one of those little toys. They don't last too long. I tend to crash them and break them.
What local or national businesses would you like to give a shout out to?
I'd say two of them. One, Patagonia, leading the way on environmental and equality and culture and just everything. It seems to be such a beautiful gold standard for where a lot of us want to be as a company. Another company that I really admire, would be the local, Porcano. I think how Brian operates his business and is so human-centered and how his staff absolutely adore him. I think he's done a really good job of building a quality culture that really, I think he captured lightning in a bottle with his two-location taqueria.
Yeah, well, and they have good food as well. Absolutely.
And they have great food, absolutely.
Well, I really appreciate your time and you doing the podcast. And also thank you for being such a strong community, a community member and a business owner with a social enterprise that we can all get behind. So thank you so much.
I appreciate it. Thank you. And thanks for your time.
Yeah, absolutely. Have a good day. Thanks so much.
Hey, you too. Take care, man.
A very big thank you to Farhad Ghafrizadeh from Green Drop Garage for spending some time with us on the podcast. For even more information about Green Drop Garage, including all of their services, visit greendropgarage.com and then follow them on social media at Green Drop Garage. Thanks again to our sponsor, Iron Tap Station, which is now providing delivery of a limited number of ciders and beers, as well as all cans by Cafe Go. Cafe Go is a new local food cart and taproom delivery service. Or just stop by Iron Tap Station on Miser Mondays for $1 off pints and $2 off crowlers, which is a 2-pint of any beer on the tap list in a 32-ounce can, and growler fills for just $14. Iron Tap Station, 33 taps, nothing but craft. Check out irontapstation.com or find them on social media at irontap_Beaverton. Again, we want to extend a sincere thank you to X-Ray FM for the 2020 X-Ray Award. Check out all the good work they're doing at 91.1 FM, 107.1 FM, and online at xray.fm. And thank you for checking out this episode of All of Your Business. You can visit us at allofyourbusinesspodcast.com for previous episodes, sponsors, and much more. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast and share with your friends. All of Your Business Podcast is edited at Track 11 Music in downtown Portland, Oregon.